The Guardian. Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Today, Harry's pockets picked in Spain. Police appeal for return of half of Fleet Street sports reporters. Meantime, in the Premier League, Man United blow past the Brummies. Aston Villa face Man City. Cries of "Who are you?" at Villa Park. And that was just Alan Shearer at the new French signing. We round up, etc. and so on, and then move on to the continent. There's Sid in Spain. News from Serie A, where Inter's comeback gets interrupted. And Ligue 1, Philippe Auclair gives us a little update. All that, plus posts and other bits, and love for Blackburn Rovers in Football Weekly. OK, hello everybody. That's you, Sean Ingle.
Hello, James.
Hi, Sean. There is John Ashdown.
Hello.
Not Scott Murray, like it says in my notes. Hi, John.
I was going to try
well and compare. Well, him out the way as he tried to come in.
I've had a shave and cut my hair and that sort of thing.
Yeah, all right then. And a shoe-in for our French correspondent, Philippe Auclair.
Good morning.
Hey. Bonjour. Yeah. What's the difference between Richard Keys and Shane Warne? Keys, he doesn't fancy women on the line. Yeah, that's the big talking point this morning, but we'll get on to that later on. Not because we want to have a go at anybody, but just because there's a little window onto the difficulty that some professionals in this game are currently encountering. I'm talking about the women, not the presenters having to do.
I wouldn't have a go at people, but all good.
Sean Ingle, tell you what, he's up in arms, and he does boxing training. So that to come. First up, though, Aston Villa, Man City. What a win for Villa.
What a win for Villa.
Yep.
Precisely.
Yep.
How many shots on target for Manchester City?
I don't know. How many?
Quite a few, I think.
Ben, one
chance. No, but what a superb win, actually,
right,
for Aston Villa.
Yeah.
And the proof that the season starts in January for Gerard Houllier, I think.
That's something you've been talking about for a while, Philippe. I'd be interested to know, you're quite close to Gerard Houllier. How has he coped? Because there was talk even before Christmas that he might be for the chop, and yet he seems to perhaps have smoothed things over. The fact that Villa prepared to spend so much on Darren Bent suggests that Randy Lerner and others are behind him.
Yeah, in his mind there was never any doubt. I think that Paul Faulkner and Randy Lerner, General Krulak, I don't know, but certainly these two were well behind Gerard Houllier, and he knew there would be funds available. And it's amazing because it's been said, you know, the money spent on Jean McCune and Darren Bent, that it was a kind of desperate throw of the dice, whereas actually it was something that was planned before. They knew they had areas in which they needed to strengthen. The fact that they spent as much money as that might not have been planned, but the idea that Jean Houllier would be given funds in January was there from the beginning.
All right. Optus Sports pointed out that Bent had one touch of the ball inside the opposition penalty box and got a goal from it, the winning goal, which is pretty much what he does. And, of course, he's scored on his Premier League debut for Aston Villa, Sunderland and Charlton now. But what about McCune, who didn't feature, but many people suggest could be equally, if not more, important to Villa in the long run?
I think it could be because he's not... I mean, he's a defensive midfielder, but who has a capacity to... first of all, technically, he's extremely good, extremely sound, very powerful. But I think he's a bit more imaginative and a bit more forward-thinking, so to speak, than, for example, Stylian Petrov or Nigel Riococca. So he can really bring a little bit more energy, a bit more dynamism, and a bit more imagination. He's a terrific player.
Is he sort of Vieira Mark II?
No, different. I mean, he's stockier than Patrick, for starters. But he's a player who's had, you know, dips in form, and... I think actually this transfer was a bit in the balance because just as McCune was out of favour with Lyon when the negotiations started and they came to an agreement pretty early on, suddenly McCune got back into the OL team. And OL, to their credit, stayed true to the word they'd given to their player and to Villa. It's quite rare enough to be mentioned.
Michael Friel tweets in saying, "Can Philippe let us know what French wonders, which other French wonders we can expect coming to Villa Park? Because that's
right
very
now,
much his supermarket, isn't it?"
Well, you say that, but you know, he went to the northeast.
That's true.
So at the moment, I think nobody. I know that they have a couple of targets, but for June and July, so it's a bit too early to talk about those. But there'll be more reinforcements coming at the end of the season.
All right, then. Aston Villa, eh? And of course, they're back in action Tuesday night. Taking on, well, they're away to Wigan.
Oof. It's a really interesting game because both sides have struggled recently. I think Wigan have won 1-6. Wigan are one of those teams that I can't understand. Regularly when I see them, I think they're the worst team in the Premier League by a considerable distance. And yet, you know, they've beaten some very good teams and, you know, drawn with the likes of Arsenal. But I would, you know, you would think if, you know, if you, with Bent there, you'd think Villa might kick on, but we shall see.
I mean, Wigan, it's really strange. You might remember, I think, how many were they beaten by Chelsea? Was it five?
Six.
And the amazing thing is that they actually were the better team for 45 minutes. And they have this completely schizophrenic. They can look great. And then suddenly, I was at the Emirates on Saturday, and there was nobody there. It could have been 6-7, 8-0 at halftime if it hadn't been for Al-Habsi, as we all know. And they were absolutely terrified. Absolutely terrified.
Hmm. Arsenal with a big win there. Are they the main rivals for United now, Arsenal?
Yeah, I think we've made a short straw poll around the table. I think two teams in it now.
John?
Yeah, no, I think the table doesn't lie, does it? And Arsenal are the sort of team that you can imagine going on a 6-7 game winning streak, which you can't see City doing at the moment. They're just too inconsistent.
All right.
I disagree. I think it's still very much three-horse race. Chelsea aren't completely out of it yet. Unlikely, but teams have made similar distance up in the past at this stage.
Chelsea was talking about Roma, what they did. Do you remember? When they came back, they were 8 points behind. When it was two wins, 2 points for a win, and they nearly did it against with Juve, and they fell, I think, on the last day of the Serie A.
In Serie A, there's been countless examples. A couple of years ago when Roma were 12 points back and then took it to the final day. But in the Premier League, interesting. Arsenal, of course, are still involved on so many fronts, and they have Ipswich midweek in the Carling Cup semi. 1-0 down from the first leg.
Yeah, doesn't mean a thing.
All right.
And everybody's fit. That's the other thing. I don't think that Wenger has had a fit team for, since when? 2003, 2004. There's always somebody missing. I mean, the only one is Thomas Vermaelen. Abu Dhabi is close to returning as well, and he might find it a bit difficult to fit in the team at the moment. So he can rotate and rotate and rotate. He will do that at Ipswich. He will do that against Huddersfield. So it's not such a big problem to have so many games.
Mm. Man United, though, continue to roll on at the top. People talk about them being, you know, undefeated but under par. It wasn't too much under par about a couple of those goals.
They were fantastic. Absolutely. And the interplay between Rooney and Berbatov and Giggs' goal was great as well. I mean, I think Berbatov's a really fascinating character. I mean, he's a top scorer now in the Premier League. He scored 17 goals. At the very top level, he hasn't scored against the top six this season. You know, he's played against Sunderland, they drew 0-0. Man City, they drew 0-0. The Spurs, 2-0. And the 0-0 away. And he hasn't scored for 2.5 years in the Champions League. Now, I think he's been fantastic this season. However, some United fans are still thinking, right, can he, the very, very biggest games, win those matches?
How much does he get played in the Champions League, Buffett?
Well, at the minute, this season he's played, I think, four or five of the six, but that's certainly a fair point for the last season. The season before that, he wasn't completely trusted.
Right. Another
thing as well is that he tends to score his goals in batches, which is generally something that you would say to somebody who is not a goal scorer. He will score three, which happened. He scored three, then nothing, then five, then not very much, then three again. And it's so with his two hat tricks and this quintuple, that's 11 of his 17 goals have come in three games, which is, you know, quite revelatory as well.
It is. Green Mile says it's almost exactly a year since I asked the pot how come Alex Ferguson was repeatedly being beaten over the head for signing the useless Dimitar Berbatov when Arsene Wenger wasn't being criticised for signing Andre Arshavin, who at that stage did even less. That's all we need, really, isn't it, listeners with long memories? But fair to say that I don't think anyone saw Berbatov as top scorer coming.
Nope.
Man United, as we mentioned, on top. They have the chance to extend their lead still further, of course, Tuesday, or it might be Wednesday, I'm not sure, when they are at Bloomfield Road in that game with Blackpool, who are, of course, in a bit of a slump. If they lose Charlie Adam, how much damage does that do to them?
Oh, it's immense. Huge, massive. He's a great player. He's a great player. He's not world-class, as some people on yesterday's Sunday supplement were talking, but he's a very, very good Premier League player.
It's a psychological blow when you lose a player like that as well, because the current mindset of the club is very much going forward at the moment. There's a lot of momentum behind them, and something like that can set you back psychologically, I think.
Mm. And with the fans, I mean, it was the player of the year, he's the player of the month every month. He has, well, more assists than anybody else, takes all the free kicks, he's the captain. I mean, it would be an absolute disaster, but I'm with you. I mean, I think if you were to leave, you could see the bottom falling off of Blackpool and going down, down, down very quickly. The one thing I'm wondering, because if they do indeed once much more money than the 4 million, which is understandable. And at the same time, you've got Liverpool going, you know, for Suarez and having to, you know, pay a lot of money for him, talking about 18 million plus a player. Will, you know, Henry and the others go as far as, you know, in terms of spending? Could they do that? Will they do that?
Indeed. Well, you mentioned Liverpool. Further discussion of the Reds will have to wait until after this little musical jingle. Kenny Daglish, King Kenny. One win in four. The man's a genius. But this was more impressive, no, from the Reds?
I think the result was impressive, but more important was the way they played. They were passing the ball around, on a, you know, putting the pitch, and it's only a very small start, but it's a start in the right direction.
Right, Torres scored two and was hungry and committed. Philip, you have the ear of Roy Hodgson, yes? Mm-hmm. What's he up to at the moment?
I think he's taking some well-deserved rest and just trying to put all this behind him.
Is he bitter?
I don't think it's in Roy's nature to be bitter.
Right.
He's probably very disappointed not to have made the most of the opportunity that was given to him. And I think what will make him smile maybe a little bit wryly, I believe is the word, after this weekend is the fact that the man of the match was the man he brought to Liverpool, Raul Mareles, who was absolutely magnificent. And that the board is now prepared to back Kenny Dalglish in a way that the board was not prepared to back him.
Well, although he had far more games than Kenny's had so far.
In terms of the transfer market. But anyway, the problem was not money. The problem was the fact that it never gelled and it never took on from, you know, the graft never took from the very first minute.
Yeah.
And it was not his fault. That's my opinion.
Oh, okay.
And also for Liverpool, I know that they were far more entertaining, so to speak, than they've been for a very long time. But the defence still looks very, very dodgy to me. I mean, the number of chances Wolves created was absolutely phenomenal.
Gerrard coming back in the next match, that'll stuff everything back up again, will it, or what?
He's a talisman.
He's a talisman, yeah. Okay. Now, also notable about this game, of course, that whole controversy over two Sky presenters, Richard Keys and Andy Gray, after they were recorded off-air having a bit of a go at the lineswoman, suggesting that she, largely because she was a woman, didn't have any hope of understanding the offside rule, which she then demonstrated that she did with a quite brilliant performance on the line. It all put the miss in misogyny or something like that. But it also gave us a bit of a window into the kind of attitude which still prevails and is faced by the many women who are officiating in top-level games. Anna Kessel now joins us, Guardian's Anna Kessel, who's actually preparing a bit of a piece about this at the moment. Anna, these ideas that Richard and Andy came up with, they're not that surprising, are they?
No, I don't think a single woman who works in the game and read these comments was the tiniest bit surprised. I think they might have been a little bit surprised by the fact that when you listen to the audio, then they're not actually laughing, they're not making a joke, they seem quite serious. I think that was probably a bit of a surprise. But no, we've heard it all before and much worse.
So is this, which has become a very public story, is this only the kind of thin end of the wedge of the kind of abuse or the kind of attitudes that, that female officials, not just, you know, from the match officials, but also, say, club officials have to deal with?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's important that people don't get confused. A lot of women working in the game have heard all of this stuff before, and it's very much sort of water off a duck's back. And what's worrying, I think, is that there's a lot more serious incidents that go on that we never hear about. And I think a lot of those women probably would never speak out about, because they're really quite serious and can range from, you know, losing your job to actual physical abuse. And so I think we shouldn't lose sight of, yes, these are two silly old codgers in a studio saying something absolutely ridiculous, but there's a lot worse things that go on.
Anna, Sean Ingle here. If someone had made a comment about a black player or used the word gay rather than a woman, would it have been seen as more or less offensive? That's a tweet from David Powell.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the Ron Atkinson situation is a perfect parallel. Absolutely the same thing. Didn't think he was, you know, live on air being broadcast. Judged someone on the basis of the colour of his skin and lost his job over it. So, you know, if you want to play things by the rule, which we like to do in the game, these two should lose their job.
And are the numbers of women, especially officiating, are they actually increasing at the moment? Because I know they're having a real crisis in terms of attracting officials in general.
Well, this is the other thing. I mean, Andy Gray and Richard Keys should know that we've got a massive problem in getting enough officials into the game. So the FA have done a huge drive to recruit And that's included women. So it's great that we've got people coming in. It's great that we've got young talent, 25-year-old women who can, you know, bust up and down the line and call great decisions. We should be very grateful that she's there.
Could I add a little coda to that,
yeah.
which has got to do with us journalists?
Yep.
I was recently at the tribute dinner for Thierry Henry, and I was sitting with a friend of mine who happens to work with the Football League. She's been working there for a while. She's been working in football for all her life. We were swapping stories about what it was like I was listening to stories of what it is like to be a woman in that male world. And she said that as recently as last year, when she went to the Football Writers' Dinner, one guy came to her and asked her the question, "Who are you with?" So, you see, if that's the way you treat women to start with, it's much better in some countries like in South America and Latin America, where mm-hmm. you have a great number of female reporters and who are genuine columnists and big name reporters.
As usual, Italy leads the way on this. You watch any football program in Italy, there'll always be a woman involved.
Yeah.
Often loads of them, actually.
Yes. But yeah. Will she be employed in that kind of capacity, my dear Jimbo?
In what kind of capacity?
As an analyst of the game and chronicler of the game.
All right. You see Ben over there saying Iker Casillas' girlfriend, who's worked her way through journalism college and risen to the very top of the profession. She's put in the graft. All right, then. If anyone's curious to know what it was that Keezy and Grazy said, when they heard that Sian Massey was going to be... There was a woman line judge, not line judge, match official, Keezy said... somebody better get down there and explain offside to her. Gray replies, "Can you believe that? A female linesman. Women don't know the offside rule." "Of course they don't," Keyes replies, etc. And it all gets worse after that. Basically, somebody better get down there and explain how microphones work. Male presenters don't understand the on-off switch. Didn't we have one of those before? Gordon Brown. Yeah. Ligue 1.
Well, it's not much of Liga. It was the cup.
Well, I know, but before that, yeah, and all the big sides.
We had one very important game.
Well, you had the Ligue 1 returned, and Lille became the latest leaders. My
yes.
word, it's all going Ligue 1,
yeah,
isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's fairly tight. I mean, there's a little bit of daylight now for Lille.
Right. Four points.
I mean, since that time we talk about Ligue 1, there's actually been, I would say, the natural order as. Somewhat been restored. Do you remember there was a point when Brest, for example, were top of the league?
Don't recall that at all.
No, of course not. But if you look now at the...
Paris Saint-Germain were up there as well.
Well, Paris Saint-Germain, which is, you know... the
Marseille.
The club is actually enjoying quite a remarkable revival, which is not just due to the coach, but I would say particularly to the chairman, Robin Le Prou, who has really done an awful lot, first of all, to sanitize what on this. But it's starting to... I would say that the normal order of things is starting to be restored. But there was one game this weekend which was very, very important.
Mm. This is the French Cup you want to talk about?
No, I want to talk a bit about the French Cup because it has a direct link with what's happening in Ligue 1.
Oh, okay.
It's the victory of Lens, their second victory on the trot, which means for the first time since the 11th of September, Lens is out of the relegation zone. And it's coincided with the appointment of Laszlo Bologny, whom you remember was an absolutely fabulous player. Hungarian name, but Romanian. And he's a bit of a disciplinarian, very much of a disciplinarian. And he's taken that team. It obviously had a terrific effect on it. So I think an awful lot of people will be glad to see that Lens, who is one of our great clubs, seems to be climbing out of danger.
All right.
But the French Cup is very interesting.
Well, the French Cup, I mean...
What happened, yes.
Well, all the big clubs got knocked out because
exactly.
They don't want to be in the cup, I'm guessing.
If you looked, I looked at the lineups of all the squads because it started in the round of 32 was an absolute slaughter the worst we'd ever seen in the history of Ligue 1 of the number of clubs falling by the wayside. And now we are back to the last 16. There's only seven Ligue 1 clubs left, five from Ligue 2, two from National, which is the equivalent of League 1, two from CFA, which is the equivalent of League 2, and we've got one, which is from CFA 2, which is the equivalent of the Conference, who've just beaten two League 1 teams on the trot, and honestly, there was absolutely no injustice or luck element in it.
So we're going to have another Calais then, are we?
Well, it looks like it, and they've already beaten Monaco and Brest, and Chambéry we're talking about from the Alps, and they've drawn Sochaux at home for the next game, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
But what it shows is that the clubs have actually, the Ligue 1 clubs have actually fielded teams which are quite strong.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it shows two things. A, that the quality of the squads The squads are very thin as a whole in Ligue 1. And two, that on the other hand, the density of French football over the first four or five divisions is quite extraordinary, because most of the players who are in those small clubs, all these giant killers, are actually players who have been trained and coached in big clubs. And one example is Malik Faye, who scored the winning, or well, scored the equalizing goal for Chambéry, was actually a Saint-Etienne player before that. So it shows that the level...
It's very dense.
It's very dense, but it's not getting any higher at the top. That's my concern.
Oh, all right, then.
You know, Bordeaux was beaten, for goodness sake.
Bordeaux
was beaten by Angers, and, okay, away from home.
Yep.
And, oh, there's a great one about Bordeaux.
All right.
Quotes from
you see,
the...
You see what you've done now? Come on.
Okay, it's a great quote.
Yes.
You're going to have to bleep everything, every other word.
Right.
It's from Moussa Mahazou, who is the player from CSK Moscow, who was loaned out to Bordeaux.
Top scorer.
Well, so to speak, yes. And he went on the record talking about his team at the moment, who are not doing very well, and said, I don't give a about what's happening. He used the French expression, which is to beat my own because I've already got a contract with Moscow. Exactly. Right. And so you can imagine the kind of atmosphere
there is in
Bordeaux.
How do you say that in French then, Philippe?
I can't say
no,
that.
No, say it
there
in French.
There are loads of people...
Say it in French.
No.
French francophones, listen away now.
Je m'en bats les couilles.
Wow.
Yeah.
He said that?
Yeah, he said that. Oof. Exactly.
I'm going to have a little explicit tag on iTunes.
Wow. Tell you what. Pardon my French and all that. Serie A... Nothing. Got nothing to match that. Another cracking goal from Ibrahimovic. Every week, the fellow. Every week, you know. It's funny, Richard Williams wandered up. He just revealed himself to be a Milan fan, actually, Richard Williams. He said, it's great to see you. I finally can appreciate Ibrahimovic now because he's playing for my team. I've never seen him in this form. He is. And, you know, when he first arrived in Italy, it was Capello who said, he reminds me of Van Basten. At that point, it was Van Basten without the goals, which is quite a key component of Van Basten's career. Now he really is looking like the Swan of Utrecht to get all over again, reborn, as they used to call him. But there you go. So, anyway, they won against Cesena, admittedly, at the San Siro, not a huge result. What was big, of course, was Leonardo losing his first game at the helm of Inter. And they were really taken apart at the Friuli Stadium by Udinese.
I was really impressed with Udinese.
Yeah.
I thought they were just... the way they went into...
They lost something like their first eight games of the season under Guidolin. And he's turned them into the best footballing team. Well, one of the best in Europe, really. And the question there, and we were talking about Charlie Adam before, is if they can hang on to Alexis Sanchez, because they are the ultimate selling club, Udinese. And although that has changed a little bit, they've hung on to Di Natale for a while. But Sanchez looks.
But they're about as unfashionable as leather pants, aren't they? They're kind of one of these clubs.
I'm seeing a lot of leather kecks out there on the streets.
Actually, they are.
There you go. Anyway, the top bit now reads Milan 44. Then Napoli, who beat Bari. They riffed on Bari's pain there. They're looking good as well, Napoli. They're 4 points behind his second. Then you've got Roma, who are good. They're not looking great, Roma, but they're creaking along there. And hello, Philippe.
No, about Roma, I just wanted to touch on something, which is the... I want to ask you, actually, because I'm trying to understand what the situation is there at the moment, because it is crazy, as we know, because it's the bank that's not now running it. And I was talking to a few friends who are Romanistas, and they're very, very worried, because what's happening at the moment is that some of their key players, Philippe Mexès, among others, who was absolutely fantastic, by the way, this weekend... they're on the verge of doing something which is to extend their contract, but with all the clauses brought down to such a level that in May or June, if they see that there is no new owner, ciao, I'm off. And so it's not very good, is it?
Well, the whole club's been in that situation for a fair while now, and they keep saying that these American owners, these American acquirers are about to come in, but the weeks go by without any sign of them turning up. I think that the likelihood is that either Mexes or Vucinic is going to be sold off quite soon, which is very worrying because it means Totti will come back into the team. Otherwise, I mean, we should talk, and maybe we'll do this on Thursday, we should talk about Bologna, who are an extraordinary story in Italy. All the problems they've been through about three prospective owners. They are the Portsmouth, really, the kind of trajectory that Portsmouth had last season. That's what Bologna are going through now. But unlike Portsmouth, they are not in the bottom whatever. They've had points taken off them twice this season. They have Di Vaio in exceptional form. The later person who was going to take over has just walked away from the club. So it's a complete mess. But they beat Lazio this weekend in a very feisty affair that ended with a kind of a bit of a brawl on the sidelines. Players coming off the bench to get stuck in. Zarate hitting the linesman. Whoa, by accident. It wasn't a Zarate kick, no, Ben. He hit him. Yeah, by accident, as I say. Anyway, see, if that had been a woman linesman, and this is a serious point, wouldn't have happened. Eurosport site saying today, make all match officials women because players might behave themselves a bit better. Good. Sid in Spain, is that a part three special? It is. Sid Lowe in Spain.
Ah, hello.
Ah, hello to you too, Sid. You're on the line with the 15th most manly man in, well, mandom.
You are deeply manly, James.
That's true. I'm quite surprised to have made this list.
You're talking about? You're so manly, James, yes, that you will be allowed to be involved in football.
Exactly, exactly. Sean Ingle.
I'm just going to ask you.
Don't be disingenuous, Sean.
No, producer Ben called me on the way in and said, asking about James about his FHM appearance.
It's FHM magazine. They told their readers, they provided 20 candidates and said, can you vote for these in terms of how they best represent the modern man? And
So rather than finishing 15th, what you actually finished was 5 from bottom.
Yeah, but I made their 20.
20 men,
Sid,
yeah,
to be fair, I made their 20.
Well, that's pretty good, actually, James.
I'm ahead of Vladimir Putin. Cristiano Ronaldo is right behind me, which is a bit worrying, actually. I'm ahead of James May. He's in my dust, to use a kind of, you know, motorsport thing. But no, the number one was David Beckham.
While we're on the subject of random things, did anyone else here get the...
It's not random.
The advert...
There's nothing random. That's scientific. Yeah, anyway, go on, Sean.
No, go on. But I was going to ask, has anyone here also had the email from a casting director looking for a sports journalist aged 35 to 40 with a baby to be the international face of Dove?
Funnily enough, Sean, I actually replied to them and told them that I didn't qualify on any of the counts, but they should contact you.
Really? Have you applied? Because Barney Rone would be my choice.
Well, Barney, I think, has had the email as well, has he? But
I think so, yeah.
But it's at €10,000.
Really?
Exactly. That's why I recommended you, Sean.
And then, which is not, I mean, I wouldn't do it because I've got some integrity, but...
What's wrong with that? Advertising soap?
Yeah, it's Dove. I mean,
why do they want a journalist?
I use Dove all the time.
Shower gel things.
For myself and my young baby. Before I'm on the way to my sports journalism job.
You're not under 40, though, are you?
I could be. Anyway, Sid, it's been great talking to you.
I tell you what, a biro on that final page of the passport and you're well under 30.
Yes. Now, Sid, best game by miles this weekend was Valencia 4, Malaga 3.
Fantastic. Really good fun. It was all a bit mad. The defending was absolutely shambolic. The refereeing was pretty bloody awful as well. Malaga, my favourite particular stat of this game is that Malaga scored with 11 men, they scored with 10 men, and they scored with 9 men, and they lost 4-3 in the last minute.
Aww.
They had two players sent off, one Martin Demichelis for being basically pretty stupid, and the other Helder Rosario, and I think he was probably a little unlucky. He was accused by the linesman of producing what's always described in Spain as a sleeve cutter. I'm not quite, it's sort of an up yours gesture, you know, where you bring one arm across the forearm of the other arm.
All right.
I'm not convinced he actually did. Julio Baptista played really, really well. It's just a really good, fun, slightly mad match. And the bit that made it so much fun was the Valencia coach, Unai Emery, who celebrated the goal by ripping off his jacket, throwing it to the floor in disgust, jumping on it, kicking something across the turf, and then sitting back on the bench and waving his hands in the air as if to say, I hate you all, you're all a bunch of absolute thingamajigs. And yet it was his team that had scored the winner, not conceded it.
Amazing.
Because he was furious at how bad they'd been, basically, Valencia. And it was classic because Valencia fans, and apologies to those Valencia fans who listen to us, Valencia's fans have a bit of a reputation in Spain for being the biggest turncoats of the lot, for being the quickest to get on the players' backs, the quickest to get at their coach. And this was one of those brilliant occasions where they could cheer and moan in the same match. Beautifully in Spanish football, you get out your hankies and you wave them when something's brilliant, but you also get out your hankies and wave them when something's bloody awful. So they were able to just keep their hankies out all game long, the Valencia fans.
That's excellent. And Malaga, so this rotten streak of form continues, however much money they throw at the team.
Yeah, their run, I think I'm right in saying, I'm just going to very quickly looking at it now, I think I'm right in saying they've won just one in six. They're the heaviest spenders in Spain over the winter window. They had five new players on the pitch at the weekend. They're now back into the relegation zone. I think they'll come out of it because I think they've got some very good players now. I think they've got a reasonably good coach, even though it's not working for them. But they were really, really unlucky on Saturday night. In fact, they would say they were robbed. They're going to write a letter to the Spanish Football Federation to complain about the refereeing, and I have to say, I think that's pretty pathetic.
Yeah, I might agree with you there. A couple of posts for you here, Sid. Captain Spiff, who by his little avatar, it's actually Spaceman Spiff from the Bluey Club Bluey. That he's referring to, says,
sorry, Ken. I have no idea what you're talking
about.
Well,
he does. He does. And can I salute you for your choice of character? Because they're one of my favourites. Can you comment, says Captain Spiff, who will win the simmering conflict between Valdano and Mourinho? And I don't understand how Valdano has managed to get the title of philosopher of football.
Yeah, well, it's a very, very difficult situation, this, and I think one of the things that helps to answer that question more than anything else is the fact that it's also the thing that possibly most disappoints Mourinho, and I think Mourinho has been disappointed more than anything else by the fact that it's very clear that Jorge Valdano has had much more support from the president Florentino Perez than Mourinho ever imagined. I think, quite honestly, Mourinho felt that he could bully his way into a strong position, go directly to the president, which he clearly does on a number of things, and essentially circumnavigate Valdano, and at some stage, possibly, even push Valdano towards the door. That's not happening, and it's very interesting that the very, very few things that Florentino Perez has said have largely been to reinforce Valdano's position. Valdano himself said in a post-match interview, I think it was last week's game, or maybe it was the midweek Copa del Rey game, that when he speaks, he is speaking for the club. Now, of course, Valdano is also being slightly mischievous in that. But I think the conflict is greater than it really needs to be. Mourinho complains that he believes that he's under attack all the time, that he hasn't been given the authority that he demands. In particular, he hasn't been given, of course, the striker that he really wants. And actually, he's quite right on some things, but it's a bit strange, really, because Mourinho has been given far more authority than any previous Real Madrid coach has ever been given. He's been given far more protection from the media than any previous coach has been given, although now that protection is starting to slip away because, of course, you know, Mourinho can be quite good at winding people up, let's put it that way. And that's kind of lost him some of the support that maybe he had earlier in the season. It's also true that Real Madrid are trying to get the number nine now that he wants, and they're pushing for it. And there's also a bottom line, which is the economic reality of the club is that there isn't the money to buy the number nine that Mourinho wants right now.
Mm. Sid, I've heard that Van Nistelrooy was willing to pay half his transfer fee, which is a small transfer fee from Hamburg, to play for Real Madrid, but that Florentino Perez had said, no, we don't want to pay any penny. Is there any truth in that?
Yeah, essentially what happened, and this is one of the things that I find really quite bizarre about this, Real Madrid approached Hamburg about getting Van Nistelrooy. Said, we really like Van Nistelrooy, please, because we desperately need a striker. And it's almost as if they expected Hamburg to say, yeah, sure, you have Van Nistelrooy here, take my wife as well. Because Real Madrid offered absolutely nothing. They just assumed that Hamburg would, here, give him the player. And of course, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is just the sensation that Real Madrid had, which is almost kind of like, well, it's our need, and therefore it's really important. And I think that the arrogance that's bound up in this. Secondly, of course, Real Madrid believed that the attitude of Van Nistelrooy would be key. A player that wants to go will be able to force his way out the door. But Hamburg's response was, well, you need a striker. We need him too. It's not like he's sitting on our bench. He's playing every game. He's very, very important to us. We want an offer. Real Madrid, according to some of the Spanish media, offered around about 2 million. And as you say, Van Nistelrooy is supposedly offering half of that to try and get his exit. And of course, he clearly does want to go to Real Madrid. But Hamburg, at the moment, at least, are standing strong. They, according to people I've spoken to in Germany, they are Hamburg very, very disappointed with Real Madrid's attitude. And that, in a way, has entrenched them in thinking, no, we're not going to let this player go.
Sid? That's fantastic, Sav. Many thanks for that.
James, we did miss something. I'm sorry to jump in. Well, talking about this Mourinho thing, yeah. I don't know if you heard about the Spanish Football Federation this week.
No.
The Spanish Football Federation, now obviously Mourinho has been talking a lot about the referees this season, and the Spanish media in particular, the Madrid-based media, has talked constantly about referees supposedly being out to get Real Madrid, and there's a conspiracy against them and so on. Well, the Spanish Football Federation this week, they changed the referees for one of the games because the referee was injured. So it came down to the Spanish Football Federation's official website to change it and to put a note up saying, well, instead of being so-and-so, so-and-so, the referee will be so-and-so. So there's this report up, and then further down the report it says, and the referee for the Madrid derby in the Copa del Rey will be Turienfo Alvarez, who will be under the watchful eye of Jose Mourinho, who has recently felt the referees are against him, full stop. Now, as you can imagine, Real Madrid went absolutely bonkers over this, and they put out a statement saying that this shows that the federation is prejudicial against Real Madrid. It's prejudicing referees against us. It's showing that they're not impartial as they should be, and so on and so forth. And the federation's response to this, I thought, was absolutely classic. They came out and said, "Ah, yeah, it was the work experience girl."
I can't believe they let a girl in doing work experience there, the Spanish Federation. Tell you what.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It is amazing. Sid, that is fantastic. We look forward to catching up with you, maybe with those Copa del Rey semi-finals, on Thursday.
Looking big, and let's hope, please hope, that Madrid and Barcelona don't reach the final.
Exactly, yep. Okay, super stuff, Sid.
Bye then.
Listen, Slasher posts in, did I hear Jimbo say that the end, because this is much more important, that the ending of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade is a bit of a letdown? Come on, Jimbo, the ending is decent enough, and it is in Petra, which is, like, amazing. I did explain this in last Thursday's pod, but guest producer, somehow, he chopped out my explanation. It's really simple. That knight has been in that cave with the Holy Grail for, what, about 1,000 years? And he's speaking contemporary English. It wouldn't have taken a massive leap for them to just kind of just give him a couple of these and thous in there so he didn't say, all right, Indy, how are you doing, mate?
But he's also alive after 1,000 years.
Yeah, because he's kept alive by the Grail. Okay. But there's nothing about kind of contemporary language skills being infused by the drinking from the Grail, is there?
What I don't understand is that the BBC show the Indiana Jones series every January, and it still gets 4 or 5 million people.
Yeah.
Surely everyone has seen it by now.
Yeah, or at least it's a film you love to watch again and again.
At least spent $3.99 on the DVD.
Or recorded it.
Well, it's free on the DVD, that's the thing. Or record it, as you say, Philip. Yeah,
but if you want to watch it again and again, surely you buy
the something. You know,
can I tell you that the DVD of The Last Crusade will cost you more than $3.99?
You've checked?
No, I actually just bought the box set the other day, so I could get my favourite, Crystal Skull. Have that, listeners. It's the best one. Anyway, moving on.
Lost Art was the first film I ever watched.
In the cinema?
Yeah, my dad took me along, and it was a choice between The Time Bandits and Raiders Lost Ark. And
I went to Raiders. Well, yeah, it was a win-win situation.
And then
the
second time he took me was to Conan the Destroyer. It was an 18 film. I was seven.
All right.
And he was told that he couldn't let me in.
First film you saw in a cinema, John Ashton?
E.T.
Really? Philippe?
Oh, my gosh. I'm going to show my age. Probably something like The Jungle Book.
Really?
Yeah.
Not something French and kind of...
Le Livre de la Jungle.
Oh, okay.
Okay, better, isn't it?
Perfect, that's nice. Mine was Dougal and the Blue Knight. It was a major roundabout film. But my first adult film was Live and Let Die, which I saw when I was about seven.
You call that an adult film?
Yeah, it was an adult film. Not a French adult film, but I saw those a bit later. And I was staying with Barry in Vienna. Everton, West Ham. Now, a couple other things from the Premier League we need to talk about. West Ham, how ironic, eh? They have to keep Avram Grant on, because they made a complete mess up of the whole situation. And what a result for him, eh? And it's a shame, isn't it? Because Piquion, that red card, what do we feel about that? Piquion getting sent off after celebrating what would have been the winning goal, and then Everton come back. And was it because the West Ham were man down? I mean, it does seem very unfair, doesn't it? He scores the second West Ham goal. They were 2-1 up. And he's so excited. He runs over to the fans. I think he jumps over the advertising hoarding. Doesn't take his shirt off, but just goes over to the edge of the stands and celebrates with them, and then gets a second yellow.
Incitement, though, isn't it? We've seen it on countless occasions, players doing that and not being booked.
Yeah.
It's absolutely scandalous. It's the most scandalous refereeing decision of the weekend.
Really? And it was
Peter
from a
Walton,
man as well.
Isn't it? Peter Walton, is that right?
Very possibly, yeah.
Okay, let's give his name.
Yeah.
I was absolutely shocked when I saw that. I thought, this is absolutely disgraceful.
But it's not only Peter Walton's fault, is it? It's the fat cats in the suits somewhere up there in some tower munching on their buffets. I don't think
Peter Walton would have had anybody complaining about the fact he didn't give a second yellow
regulation
card to Frederick Piquion.
Well, the regulation says that if you... Something around.
I'm sure we can all think of number. I mean, what was the difference when Marouane Fellaini came to celebrate his goal? He was about a yard away from the fans. He was not.
It's interesting.
Piquion was not taunting anybody.
No,
he scored. He scored for a team that's struggling against relegation. Yeah. He scored what should have been the winning goal.
Yeah.
Celebrates with his fans.
Christ. Oh, honestly, it's absolutely disgraceful.
I'm with you, Philippe, and this is the kind of thing that broadcasters should be speaking out about, not women with flags. That's just my message out to you. Interesting, the West Ham now playing Birmingham in the League Cup. The first leg of this, it was Avram Grant on the brink, and now it's McLeish, who's very much possibly facing a must-win fixture.
Well, I think McLeish is unhappy at the moment. He wants to bring a few players in, hasn't been able to. And it's quite interesting as well that Peter Panu, who's the acting chairman of Birmingham, as today, asked whether Carson Young has had value for money for the players he McLeish has brought in over the past year or so. He says, Carson has spent in aggregate $26.3 million since his arrival. I mean, McLeish would argue that you get at least that from playing the Premier League every year. If you get relegated, you lose a lot more. But the morale, from what I understand, isn't good. Birmingham now have to play West Ham, and then they have a game against Man City at home, then they play West Ham away again, then they face Stoke at home, and it's really a tricky period for them.
Have we got to the point of people being named as potential successors for McLeish at Birmingham?
No, I think that's a little early.
Okay, now let's finish off a quick nod to Newcastle, who lose the lead in injury time at the very last minute for the second week in a row, and Blackburn. There's clearly a lot to be said for not knowing what you're doing, because the club that we laughed at for saying they were going to go for the top five are now up to seventh. John?
Yeah, I did the minute by minute on it yesterday. They didn't play particularly well, but they played better than West Brom, who are hopeless at the minute. Really, really sterile and never really looked like scoring. I mean, well, I'd say never really looked like scoring. They just sort of flopped and flapped around for 90 minutes and made it reasonably easy for Blackburn, certainly with the first goal, which was a horrendous own goal from Gabriel Tamás just before half time. And yeah, I mean, they're up to seventh, the Europa League beginning to look like a possibility, which is on one level unbelievable. But at the same time, we did sort of say the general perception after Big Sam went was, oh, well, that's it then. Everybody was sort of predicting doom and gloom for Blackburn. But Keane does have a bit of hindsight kicking in, I suppose. But Keane had a very good track record as an assistant manager and a coach in the game, very widely respected. And so perhaps we shouldn't be that surprised that he's doing a competent job.
He was Chris Coleman's number two at Fulham, Sociedad and Coventry. And there was some talk that he was going to be Scolari's assistant at Chelsea, but he turned it down. He played a good deal of his career in Portugal as well, after being released by Celtic as a youngster and joining Swansea City. He went off to India again at the start of the week and got offered this massive in terms of the amount of time he's been given, way beyond the end of the season, I think another two seasons afterwards. So, somebody obviously believes in him there. DJT Total says, Junior Hoylett to finally fulfil his academy potential and become the best player in the Premier League?
He was Blackburn's best player, along with Roque Santa Cruz, who made a difference up front, I think, with his movement. Hoylett's goal was fantastic, one of the goals of the weekend.
What kind of player are we talking about, John?
He's a tricky, jinky winger who was switching sides quite smoothly as well, so he's clearly capable of playing on either side of midfield. Yeah, he looks a talent.
Even when they got absolutely thrashed at Chelsea, he was actually looking pretty good, and he was actually the only one, if I remember, drew that save from Petr Cech, and who looked really lively up front. Yeah, definite prospect.
It's a difficult league to call, though, because if Liverpool win their game against Fulham, they'll go into seventh, I think, 1 point above Blackburn. So,
really?
Yeah, it's
Liverpool in Europe.
I think there's a difference of only 10 points between seventh and last at the moment, which at this stage of the season is completely crazy. I think it's 10 points between seventh and last.
It's all bonkers. Very good. Well, let's let it have a couple more midweek matches, and we'll see what happens after all of that. And we'll be back on Thursday with Football Weekly Extra. In the meantime, many thanks. Merci beaucoup to Philippe Auclair and John Ashdown.
No problem.
Sean Ingle, also much gratitude to you. Producer Ben, top stuff. And you, the listener, many thanks for being on board in a very real sense. We're back on Thursday. Hope your week goes well until then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.